from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Governor Jerry Brown says online college courses could help solve some of the problems facing the state's education system.
We've got to invest in learning, in teaching, in education, and we do that not by just the way we did it 100 years ago. We keep changing.
The governor is fostering partnerships between online learning programs and higher education, including a newly inked deal between San Jose State University and the startup Udacity. Can low-cost online classes help keep education affordable and maintain the quality of a university lecture? We'll try to answer those as well as other questions you may have about online college courses and whether they are indeed the wave of California's future. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Online education was up for discussion with Governor Jerry Brown in attendance yesterday at a UC Regents meeting, and under pressure from Governor Brown, a pledge was made by the Regents to offer more classes online to provide wider educational access and to keep costs down. The governor also was at a press conference where announcements were made of a pilot project partnership between San Jose State and the startup pioneer company in online courses, Udacity, to offer three low-cost-for-credit courses online in mathematics, elementary statistics, and college algebra. Is online teaching the wave of the future for higher education in California and, for that matter, for the nation? Well, joining us for this morning's hour discussion is the president of San Jose State, Moy Kayomi. He's with us by phone from the San Jose State campus, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Sebastian Thrun back with us here on Forum, Google vice president who is conceiving of flying cars. We'll have to have a conversation in the future perhaps on that with him, but he's also a fellow and part-time research professor at Stanford, founder of Udacity, a company that offers university-level education to the public. Welcome back to Forum.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you. Also good to have with us Michael Moranz, who is professor of history at UCLA, also co-edits the education blog Remaking the University and co-edits it with UCSB professor Christopher Newfield. Welcome, Michael Moranz.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, President Kayomi, with you, and begin by just talking about a little bit for background here's sake for listeners. Governor Brown cited long waiting lists and high failure rates in remedial courses, but I noticed that the provost, Ellen Jun, at your university said over 50% of entering students at San Jose State can't even meet basic requirements.
Good morning, Michael. Basically, if you look at the entire CSU or San Jose State, a large number and about 58% of the students who enter who are college eligible, they need to take some remedial math or English courses or both. And that basically is what Provost John was referring to. So what really happens when students enter San Jose State or San Francisco State or any other CSU campuses, they end up taking some remedial courses that could last for a semester or two semesters, and those courses do not count for their college credit. So that what that means is that they end up spending a longer period of time towards graduation. Some of them may become discouraged and leave the university and not even return. And they spend a lot of money as well as costing the state quite a bit of money. So that basically has been the motivation to see how we can make sure that students could do that remedial math actually before even coming to campus.
Well, you've got the largest university system in the nation. You're going to be offering these courses with easier access, $150 for each course, which is certainly reasonable. And you've got $45,000 coming from a stipend, which is not from taxpayers. So this all looks good, but there are people worried that it's going to be moving on a trajectory toward more and more online education. Is that the plan?
Well, part of it is that I look at online education as one of the other elements of providing high-quality, accessible education to our students. So I don't think you can look at anything, you know, whether it's online or any other approach, as that silver bullet. So as part of the number of different approaches that we have, we certainly think that technology offers a number of solutions and opportunities, and certainly the online education and the approach that Udacity is doing is going to be part of that one of those approaches for us.
Well, this is San Jose Plus, is indeed the name of the program, and I'm just wondering about how much faculty were involved. You had sociology professor who's acting vice president of CFA, the faculty union, Professor Purdy, Preston Purdy, saying it was no accident this announcement was made when faculty were off campus.
Well, first of all, one of the things that I've always believed is that the centrality of the faculty's role in the delivery of education, it's very important. So from the beginning, our faculty members were involved. These three courses that you mentioned are designed by our faculty. It's the curriculum is our faculty. Udacity has helped in seeing how we can put it online. And as these courses start, they will be from the day one till the final exams, our faculty will be very much in the center of it and will be involved. Now, the reason that we had to make the announcement right now is a matter of timing, because if we wanted to make sure that these courses will be available for our students in this spring semester, as well as students outside the university. So that was the reason as to why we made the announcement last week. We had been working with our faculty. We had discussions with our Academic Senate a week or so before that one, but some of our faculty members who designed these courses, as you would expect, the design of a course takes some time. It started several months ago.
That's President Mo Kayomi, who is president of San Jose State University, with us by phone. I had to mention the Department of Education research on remedial courses back in 2009 said that there's better online performance than face-to-face, in addition to cost savings. Make of that what you will, but that did come out by the Educational Research Organization. And Sebastian Thrun is well, been involved in this for a while. He's head of Udacity and, as I said, a vice president over at Google. And what, you got a call from Governor Brown that's kind of started this thing in motion, this program?
Yeah, out of the blue on June 16th last year, we've been working on this thing called MOOCs, Massive Open Online Classes. The first one we did at Stanford attracted 160,000 students. And Governor Brown heard about it and contacted me and said, look, we have a crisis in California. Can you please help? And here I am trying to help.
Well, it's an experiment in many respects. Don't know how it's going to work, really, do we?
We don't know how it's going to work. It's an experiment. We have to learn from the outcomes. We are clearly limiting attendance and enrollment right now to 300 students, 100 per course, so that if everything goes wrong, we can basically back up and fix it. We couldn't do this if we had 10,000 students.
But you got outside evaluations up ahead under a National Science Foundation grant. Is that right?
Yeah, the National Science Foundation gave a grant to San Jose State to do research. To my knowledge, it's the first time the National Science Foundation has actually sponsored research on outcomes and methodology for these massive open online classes. And there's a lot of excitement in Washington to do the research necessary to understand if this new way of educating works.
Well, Udacity, and we talked before about this, has designed a number of courses to be more interactive than the usual online courses, and hats off to you for that. But, you know, the criticism is that this is the academic analogy to having a social life through Facebook or something along those lines. In other words, that you don't get the interactivity that you get when you have face-to-face professor, lecturer, teacher.
Yeah, and what we're doing right now is we're not directing it to replace face-to-face interaction. We're really directing it to reach people who have no access right now. So we have a huge number of high school students, and especially in inner city schools, they often have no access to things like AP credit. And this is a path to get college credit and get you advanced into college even before you enter college.
And how are you going to monetize these courses? I mean, I know that there are certainly a lot of notions of this eventually coming. There's a lot of venture capital, in fact, that's involved in this. But at this point, seems to be a mystery in terms of monetizing.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about how to monetize these free open classes. And we tried a lot of things. We tried placement fees and we tried to do proctored exams and special programs. But this one is different because we're actually charging a tuition fee. The tuition fee is significantly lower than what you normally pay at the CSU system, but it's still there. And we did the math. We can actually provide back really, really good services to those students in terms of instructor access and mentoring in helping people through the pipeline. So it's an experiment, but I'm quite optimistic that for the price point of $150, we can actually provide top-notch education.
Low retention rates, though, don't you have?
We have low completion rates in existing MOOCs for a number of reasons. First, the people signing up often have no business to be in that specific class or no interest. They're just curious. Secondly, there's no good way to help people through the program. When they get stuck, there's no one to motivate them. And it's really important that we have people involved doing this and providing expert opinions. And then finally, in the past, they were never really taught for credit. And this is the first time they're actually being really taught as a MOOC for credit.
And the mission is here to get more students at a cheaper cost. And in fact, at the University of California, there's an online platform developing, you know, it's about $1,400 a quarter for a course, about $2,100 for a semester. The future of this is something that could affect education throughout the world, let alone in the United States and California. I want to bring Michael Moranz into the discussion. He's professor of history at UCLA and co-edits the education blog Remaking the University with UCSB professor Christopher Newfield. And you have some concerns here. Let's talk first about the Regents meeting, though, and what was accomplished yesterday. It looks like at this point the UC system is moving in this direction, doesn't it, Michael Moranz?
I'm not sure I would refer to it as what was accomplished yesterday. I mean, the reality is that there's been a lot of use of online and digital technologies in teaching on all of the campuses for years. At UC, it's also been done in extension. Faculty have been experimenting with this for quite a long time, adding things, blended courses, flipping classrooms, as they call them, throughout the whole system. I mean, what was being discussed yesterday at the Regents meeting was this centralized program out of the Office of the President called UC Online Education, UCOE, which has been around for a few years, has not generated a lot of financial support from outside the system, and has produced very little. It's been very centrally driven. I believe they've put on something like six or seven courses over the last 4 years. And the question, it seems to me, that was raised by the Regents meeting, or at least one of them, is the gap between what the governor and the Regents seem to think needs to be compelled onto the system, and what's actually going on the campuses. I mean, one of the things that was very striking yesterday was the actual distance between the Regents and any real understanding of what's going on all the different campuses.
You know, I have Jonathan Stein on the line. I want to come back to you, if I may, Michael Moranz. But Jonathan Stein, and we should say it's a very different situation at UC than it is in the CSU system. Night and day in some respects. But Jonathan Stein is the University of California student regent. He's also a law and graduate student at UC Berkeley and stepped out of the Regents meeting, which is ongoing, to talk to us, which I appreciate. Jonathan Stein, glad to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, I guess the concern that you have is no student involvement in the long-term goals, whatever they may be.
I have a number of concerns. I'm the youngest person in the room, and I'm being called a dinosaur because I think your previous speaker mentioned that there's a lot of excitement amongst the Regents and by the governor for online education, and the students remain somewhat skeptical. It is true that there's been basically zero consultation with the students who are expected to take these classes in the future about whether or not we want them. The progress thus far has been very minor, as discussed, but the goals stated yesterday during the rah-rah session we had at the Board of Regents included things like 10% of UC classes in the future will be online. The first 2 years of UC education will be online. These are goals that would dramatically reshape our education, and no one has bothered to ask whether or not we're interested.
You're concerned. Well, let me actually go back for a moment before we go on with the concerns you have about maybe a cyber university up ahead or something like it. What's on the table now? Just what you've outlined, or is there more?
No, I think that the whole thing is in flux. I don't believe that the university at this time has a concrete business model, and that was reflected in the conversation at the Regents table yesterday. Despite the fact that a number of Regents were very excited about online education, basically all of them with the exception of the student region, there were still questions about what are the primary goals here? Where are we taking this? What is our short-term objective and our long-term objective? I don't think those have been answered yet. I think our enthusiasm has outpaced our actual planning and accomplishments. And I think the enthusiasm and the press, the positive press for all this, has definitely outpaced any sort of concrete business plan.
There isn't a lot of data on cost savings, really, is there?
No, and you know what? This is part of my problem with the situation. Look, the quickest way to my heart is to talk about access to public higher education and putting more students who deserve an education through our system. I'm with that 100%. If we can get more high school students and community college students into UC, fabulous. If we can expose someone who never thought that he or she would go to higher education to the wonders of taking university classes and then she enrolls down the line, fabulous. But this wasn't initially presented as an access issue. This was presented as a financial proposal. This was supposed to save us money or make us money. And certainly when the governor talks about how he can give the UC a 5% increase in its budget, but the UC wants an 11% increase in its budget, and UC Online is going to fix that gap, he's talking about online education being a financial fix. And I just don't buy it. I mean, there are two forms of online education. There's online classes for UC students, and there's online classes for non-UC students. The online classes for UC students are extremely high touch. They involve lots of, maybe this has been discussed in your program previously, so I apologize if I'm repeating something, but lots of contact with graduate students and with faculty members. There's no cost savings there that anyone can see in the short term or even the intermediate term. And then on the
let me just back up with that cost saving for a minute, because there's an example of Antioch College, LA campus, which offers credit for two of the courses by Coursa, which is another one of these online outfits taught by University of Pennsylvania professors, and it's the first college to pay a licensing fee, so there is a revenue stream there, and it's lower tuition than you get in a four-year college.
Well, the difference may be that UC wants to do all these classes in-house, develop them using faculty time and developer time in-house, all which is very expensive, and then they have very high academic standards that they expect these courses to meet. I applaud them for that, actually, because everyone in a position of power here at the UC has been very clear that they won't move forward with online classes unless the academic quality matches the current classroom experience. And so I applaud that. But there is simply no data that this is going to save us money. It may increase access, and that's great. But this was initially pushed as a financial idea, and I don't think the finances are there.
And we're talking just with Jonathan Stein for another moment or two, University of California student region and law and graduate student at UC Berkeley. You're not exactly seeing a student groundswell for online courses, are you?
No, you're not. And I think part of that is because UC students know that while a portion of their education occurs inside the classroom, a huge portion of their education occurs outside the classroom. It's sports, it's Greek life, it's service and volunteering, it's clubs, it's student leadership. And if we're talking about a future where a huge portion of the UC education is done online, I think that we begin to lose what has made the college experience so special for so many generations. And I think that students have a sense of that.
Okay. I'm much appreciative of your spending time with us. Back you go to the Regents meeting, and thank you for being with us.
Have a wonderful day.
Jonathan Stein, again, University of California student region and law and graduate student at UC Berkeley. I want to go back to Professor Michael Moranz, who's with us from UCLA. Co-edits education blog, Remaking the University. Talk, if you would, Professor Moranz, about your concerns about what I think you've talked about in your blog or written about in your blog is the residential experience of college education, the interaction.
Yeah, let me do that. But if I could also just pick up on a couple of things that Regent Stein was saying. You know, when you mentioned something like Coursera, which is, as Sebastian Thrun knows, one of the other MOOC providers. And they talk about, well, it's a University of Pennsylvania professor at Antioch. Those are taped presentations. What Regent Stein is talking about is when online takes place now with faculty members in UC campuses, it's integrated into a lot of other actual face-to-face or immediate contact with graduate students, with faculty. It's designed to enrich the already existing class experience. And one of the things that I thought was very striking yesterday at the Regents meeting was a comment that Sebastian Thrun actually made about, you know, the advantages of some of these new technologies is that they do not necessarily replicate what happens in a residential face-to-face setting, but that they provide you an opportunity to do different sorts of things. And the problem with the way that UC is proceeding is that it doesn't really know, it seems to me, what task it is that it's trying to solve. It's being driven by the tool rather than by the question. And the fact of the matter is, as Regent Stein also pointed out, is that the residential experience is an incredibly important experience, especially for young people. There's an ecology of learning and of research. There are experiences that they get from interacting with peers, both in and out of the classroom, interacting with older students as graduate students. There's a larger system of interaction that you do not get sitting, however well designed, at a distance learning place in front of your computer.
Also seems to me that, just from reading your blogs, that you feel that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you express some skepticism.
People usually do.
I usually put words in your mouth?
No, I said people often
do. Oh, people often do. Well, I'll try not to, or abstain. No, but that this won't necessarily, or skepticism, let's call it, that this will make up for budget cuts and concern about privatization. And this is just another form of outsourcing.
Well, I think that that's true, and I also think that when you listen to the governor does not really want to confront the fact that the higher education sector in California has been dramatically cut as a political choice. If you look at the history of funding of public higher education in the state, two things become very clear if you look at it, say, over the last 30 or 40 years. One is that the decline in the percentage of the general fund going to higher education almost perfectly tracks the rise in the percentage of the fund going to the Department of Corrections. And secondly, the incredibly large cuts to the budgets have occurred roughly in the last 10 to 12 years. And they've been driven by political policies. Arnold Schwarzenegger cut. Jerry Brown has long been in favor of cutting higher education. This is not something written in the law of nature. So when Jerry Brown says, well, you all are asking for 11% and CSU is asking for this and for that, he's not recognizing that, say, UC has gotten almost $1 billion in cuts over the last several years, brought about by a financial crisis. That's a financial crisis that has its politics to it. The way it was solved has its politics to it. You know, what we need is a broader investment in the future. I think that the digital technologies, you know, again, Sebastian Thrun can talk about this, the digital technologies are certainly one tool that can be used to try to enrich education and to reach out to people. But it cannot be the central driving force, and it cannot be an excuse for not seriously thinking about where our priorities are.
All right, we are coming up on a break, and I want to hear back from the president of San Jose State, Mo Kayomi, as well as Sebastian Thrun, but also hear from you, our listeners. And let me invite you to join this conversation. We're really talking about online learning, but two different situations, San Jose State and the CSU system on the one hand, the UC system on the other hand, but the overall question of the role of online learning in terms of decreasing costs and creating greater access for students and really providing what everyone hopes education and higher education will indeed provide. You can join us toll-free, and we invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, join the program, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. We'll continue. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about online learning and really talking about two different programs, one at San Jose State University recently making a deal with a startup company called Udacity to offer online courses, and also what's happening as we speak with the UC Regents pretty much being directed in many respects by the governor to foster online learning and to do that really to reduce costs and create greater access. We speaking earlier with Jonathan Stein, University of California student regent, and with Michael Moranz, who's still with us, professor of history at UCLA, co-editor of the education blog Remaking the University. Sebastian Thrun with us in studio is a Google vice president, part-time research professor at Stanford, and founder of Udacity. And we also have President Mo Kayomi with us, who, by the way, is on the board of directors at KQED, just to make that public as well. And President Kayomi, let me go back to you on this. I mean, a bigger question here, I know these are, we're talking about two completely different programs here, but they happen to be in the news at the same time. And it just seems as if, from your perspective, this is an experiment, this is a potential other tool, but we're also talking about the efficacy, the viability, really, in the long run, or maybe even in the shorter run of this kind of learning.
Well, first of all, I think it's very important for an 18-year-old high school students to spend time in a university. I think all of us are in agreement that that's important in a number of different ways that it has already been articulated. The whole idea of having these courses is, first of all, students will be able to have a number of different options. I actually, when I was at my prior institution at Cal State East Bay, whenever we were opening any online courses, that was the first course that was being filled up, actually. The other part is that, you know, when for students to be able to do their remedial work before they get to campus, that will be such a savings for the students as well as the taxpayers and everyone. And and thirdly, if the students can do some of their courses, college courses, while they're in high school before they come to the university, I think it's going to be critically important. The cost structure that we have put together with $150 per course, we believe that after hopefully with a successful implementation of this pilot program, this will be a financially viable program without any state or federal support. And that basically is what has really excited us, that we will be able to provide opportunities for, you know, if you look at the number of students this year, over 26,000 Californians had to leave the state to go to our neighboring states to be able to get their college education, or over 470,000 students in the community colleges who have difficulty getting their courses. Now, the whole idea of saying that somebody, when they finish high school and setting them in front of a computer and 4 years later get them a college degree, that's not some, that really is not what we're talking about when we talk about online education. It's basically how you can create other venues where and opportunities where students can get some of their college education before they come to the campus, or at least be ready for college courses, and then have a blended form where they will be able to take some of their courses online as well as some that they might take face-to-face. And thirdly, let's remember, when you talk about CSU students and community college students and maybe some of the UC students, a large number of them end up working. So for them to be able to take be able to continue some work that they do part-time as well as be able to take their courses, this is going to be so tremendously important, especially when we talk about first-generation college students, especially we're talking about underserved communities and financially challenged families. So I think from all of those points, the whole idea is how we can increase access, we can lower the cost, and be able to provide high-quality education to the largest number of California residents and beyond.
And again, Mo Kayomi is the president of San Jose State University. Sebastian Thrun, I'd like to get your response to getting a lot of emails, some, as you might imagine, very positive about online learning experiences, some very negative. But here's a listener who writes anonymously, I'm a CSU biology TA, spent a lot of time teaching my students remedial math. There is absolutely no way these kids can stay motivated enough to figure out the concepts they have problems with without face-to-face interaction with an educator. Math needs to be taught in various ways until the student gets it. Online classes are another way for students to practice their Googling skills to answer web-based quizzes and exams without actually understanding concepts. Unfortunately, that is their default mode of learning when they get out of high school. Remedial classes are specifically where online courses will fail them.
Well, we had a pilot in Texas with 24 at-risk students, high school students, taking some of our college classes, and two girls, one of color, one Caucasian, finished a semester-long class in 2 weeks with distinction, and we were blown away by this fact. It turns out there's no simple solution for everybody. Some people respond very well to these online classes, and some need much more face-to-face interaction. But I want to make a few comments to some of the things said before. There's really two programs here at stake. The one proposition is, well, let's get the professors out of the classroom and replace them by videotapes. And I take issue with this as everybody else. I think this is not about existing students in the existing UC system trying to deprive them of human contact to save costs. And as far as I know, this model has been tried. I think the University of Washington had a pilot recently, and they signed up a total, from my information, of 3 students. So the students aren't that excited to lose their professor access either. What we're trying to do here is exactly the opposite, creating access to college. Professor Kayumi mentioned we have 472,000 waitlisted students who can't get into the community college system, willing to pay full tuition, turns out. But the state doesn't have enough funds to provide the resources. And these are students who are stranded, who want to learn, who want to advance themselves, and they can't. We have a huge number of high school students. I think something like 58% of the incoming student in the CSU systems fail the entrance exams, and they can't study. And that makes it costly for them because they're going to spend money and time doing remedial work trying to get ready, and that clogs the system. If we can take, with these new methodologies, and help students before they enter to get ready for college and maybe accrue college credit along the way, and we succeed in reducing the time it takes to get a 4-year degree from what's presently about 6 years, maybe down to 5 or 4 years, we can actually have more students experience college. We can have more students go through college because all of a sudden you're faster through college. And that's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for the students because they're done faster, they make money earlier, and they have less college debt. It's the win for the university system because they educate more students on exactly the same amount of money. And it's a win for the governor because we have a higher throughput. Professor Comey mentioned we're sending many, many students to neighboring states. Our California education system is underserving our student population. We're not keeping up with the rates of students who want to study. And it's a cost saver in the sense that if at the same money you can educate more students, that tends to be a cost saving.
Well, we've got somebody tweeting. Forrest says, a lot of the costs I'm hearing for online classes go beyond what I'd call low class. And Marcial writes on our Facebook page, these online classes are money-making machines. Morgan tweets, the huge push for online education smells like a way to provide education without paying teachers, which is to say dishonest. What's the difference between paying a lot to watch an online lecture and just reading a textbook or watching YouTube?
Well, it's exactly what we're trying to change. The tuition rate that San Jose State has set really passes the savings on to the students. If you were to go right now, and San Jose and many others have open programs where students can take college credit, they would often pay 5, 6, 8 times as much money for those credits. So the commitment here is not to turn this into a money-making machine, but to really help the students of California.
Let me go back to Professor Moranz, and then I want to get our callers on here. Michael Moranz, John, one of our listeners, writes, a traditional classroom experience in the UC system and the CSU system has been steadily declining for a long time. Undergraduate core classes with 100 or more students has been the norm for decades, and opportunities for students to have meaningful face time with tenure-track professors who feel increasingly pressured to devote the bulk of their time to research have become almost as scarce as sightings of Halley's Comet. People need to stop romanticizing the old way of educating students. Online education can't do much worse than the present order. I say bring it on. And what do you say to this student?
Well, what I would say is that there's a large element of exaggeration in that, although I certainly have sympathy for the extent to which students are increasingly put into large lower division lectures as well. I actually think if you looked at the statistics, you would find that that is somewhat exaggerated in its notions. You know, I recently wrote on the blog, we had a discussion about yesterday's Regents meeting, and it seems to me that, you know, one of the things that needs to be resuscitated in education is far more seminar and dialogue with faculty, with graduate students, things like this, and that increasingly they have been pushed to the margins. The question, though, again, it seems to me to be about how you do it,
What is it that you're trying to accomplish with any given thing? Sebastian Thrun, you know, comments, and I think he's right, that he's seeking to find a way to get beyond the large lectures. But the SJSU experiment, which I think is actually a quite interesting one in its effort to make up for educational losses earlier, is designed where the human contact comes from Udacity mentors. They're not graduate students. They're not people working on similar problems. They're not connected to the university. You know, one of the interesting things, if you look at the New York Times article on this, is, you know, the initial article thought that these were going to be blended courses in which there would actually be active interaction with faculty. Then they realized that there wouldn't be once the thing went online. So I think there are a lot of questions about how you make those two things possible, and I think it will be expensive. That isn't to say you shouldn't try to do these experiments, and I think this is an interesting experiment. The other thing I would say about the cost savings and the costing is, you know, there was a study done by a couple of professors who are all into statistics and stuff, who figured out that you could restore higher education funding to roughly 2001 levels at a cost of somewhere between $40 and $50 per person for a median income in California, right? Not $1,000. You know, if you were willing to raise $40 to $50 per person in California, you could bring UC, CSU, and the community college funding back up. It's, again, it's been a political decision to drive it down, and those political decisions then translate into the sort of situation that the San Jose State experiment and Sebastian Thrun and the rest of us are all trying to deal with.
I'm also trying to deal here with the fact that we have a lot of people who want to talk. So, Professor Brenz,
forgive
me. No, that's okay. I just want to get to our callers, and let me do that forthwith. Sean, you're first up here. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think the challenge for the universities is it's very hard to innovate inside a university. I am a part-time professor at the University of California, Berkeley Business School, and I teach a course in microfinance and impact investing, which I started simulcasting, so real-time video, into now about 100 different business school campuses at the same time. And this is a different kind of technology approach than what we've been calling online education. Those roughly 2,500 students can ask me questions through Skype or other sorts of chats. They see my shining bald face in their classrooms. And this allows them to get content that they otherwise couldn't get. Now, it's been very hard to get this done. And I've basically done it kind of in a grassroots guerrilla style by having the students organize these classes on each campus, and then I deliver. And it also solves the problem of people basically sitting in their underwear watching computers. They are all in a room together, and they have that interaction, and they can, you know, grade each other's work and other things like that. But, you know, it's hard to get these things rolled out across the schools, and it's very difficult.
Well, thank you, Sean. I'm glad to have your perspective. In fact, it's not only within different classrooms. The New York Times article, which Professor Moran's alluded to, talks about courses offered online that suddenly are being picked up in Korea and all of that sort of thing. I mean, you know, you've really got global access here when you're using this. But let me go to more of your calls. And Brian joins us from Sacramento. Brian, welcome.
Hi. I have an MFA from UCLA, and I just got completed 11 graduate courses at another UC campus, and the interaction with the teachers was pretty much worthless online, non-existent. I could have just taken the course by doing the textbooks and taking the tests without any interaction at all, and there was none with the students either. And just to speak briefly to the remedial classes should only be part of a community college system, not a state or university system.
All right. I thank you for that. Let me give you some sampling of what we're getting in emails here, different perspectives. Mark writes, I'm currently a student at CSU's East Bay Teacher Certificate Program, and a significant portion of my course load has been online. Strikes me as the most pathetic of ironies that we are training future educators with these pedagogically bankrupt online courses. My latest online course is only a single assignment with 90% of the grade writing on an open book multiple choice final administered online. There is no interaction with the professor except in cases of scheduling problems with the final. Someone is collecting a paycheck for this travesty. On the other hand, Morgan writes, when I was a student at the University of Michigan, we had a very large lectures, much like the online courses being discussed today, but every lecture was paired with small group discussions that met for 1 to 3 hours a week, were led by grad students. Without these discussions, honestly, the lectures were nearly useless. What fills the discussion need with these online courses is my question. And another listener writes, I was working full-time. This is Kevin. There was a new baby in the house. I needed a master's degree in order to get a teaching job at a community college. I found an accredited online MA program that was entirely asynchronous. I was skeptical, but I found that I actually learned more and worked harder for my MA than I did for my BA. It's entirely possible that my motivation was totally different at age 28 than at age 18. I was focused on career and family rather than beer and girls, but traditional in-person class or entire master's program would simply not have been possible otherwise. As far as online classes go in general, there are good ones and bad ones. If you tried one and found that it was just a recorded lecture, don't dismiss all online education. You just got a lemon. Sebastian Thurn.
This is exactly where Silicon Valley comes in, where we should remind ourselves that we are the country of innovation and we should think differently. A lot of online tries to replicate the classroom and as a result becomes very poor. But at Udacity, we have a strong instructor interaction with the San Jose State instructor. We have discussion forums. We have a very different way of exercising that really exploits the fact that these online media can go at your own pace and you can rewind the professor and try new things out. Some describe the experience much more that of a video game that you get drawn into than listening to a professor. We should be innovative. We should experiment. I'm not saying we have the right solution. Someone else might find the right solution, but we should be a country looking forward. Education has been stuck for quite a while. And if you look at what happens in large classes today, it's not that different from what happened 50 years ago. I think we should strive for more than that.
Let me get another caller on here, and that's you. Michelle, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I've had the interesting experience of being both a professor and working in the private sector for a startup company looking at online teaching partnerships, and now I work for a nonprofit think tank. And I think one of the things that needs to be said is that people look at online education as a serious threat to traditional education. And the other problem is that we also conflate these kinds of online courses with something like Udacity is doing, and they need to be distinguished from each other. A lot of universities have used online education as a kind of cash cow, and in it they've been trying to replicate exactly a classroom experience, and you just cannot do that. And that's where you see the frustration of a student experiencing, you know, nothing close to what they would expect from a face-to-face interaction with a professor. And I've actually seen some versions of these online courses at the UC, and they are extremely high contact, and they're not scalable in the way that you would assume an online course could be. And it's just not going to work for every discipline. And so what I think is really interesting about what Udacity is doing is that there's a lot of competency-based experimentation going on. And, yeah, they may not have it completely right, but I think we need to be very clear about distinguishing what some of these MOOCs are doing versus what's actually going on in extension schools or other kinds of schools that are putting their material online and using it to generate revenue.
Thank you, Michelle. Good to hear from you. In fact, we've got a whole question here, and let me go back to the president of San Jose State on this. Kayomi, a listener named Brandon, says, thank you for the show. As a non-tenure-track faculty member in the humanities, I'm wondering about what all this means to those of us who would like to make a living teaching in the humanities. How do you teach critical thinking and writing without student-teacher interaction? The only way to provide student-teacher interaction is to hire teachers.
I agree that faculty-student interaction is very important, and that's why we have started these courses as a trial in the sciences areas. And as we said earlier, nobody has all of the answers. But I'll give, you know, going back to that New York Times article, you know, I think one of the reasons that the writer was confused because we have two different online activities going, one with Udacity, as we've talked about up to this point, but also partnering with MIT edX, where last semester our students took an MIT course but the students were seeing the lectures before coming to the class, and the class time was really spent for discussions. And the results of this was that traditionally this is a very tough electric circuits course that normally 40% of the students end up getting a C or below. But this time using, in this model, using the MIT edX material, students watching the class before coming to, watching the material before coming to the class, the drop, dropped to less than 10%. So I think there was, this was a major savings for our students. Certainly the number of faculty time and, teaching assistant time was the same or actually a little bit larger, but the savings was to the students. So I think there is not one model that could really be applicable for all different approaches and all different disciplines and all different areas. I certainly agree that critical thinking requires a lot of dialogue, requires a lot of discussions, and that's why our hope is that we can look at finding different ways that we can really improve and provide high-quality education to the largest number of students with a low cost. And that basically is what has been our motivation, and hoping that what we'll, as part of this experiment, we can learn a lot of insights. And as we expand this one to other programs and other courses, we can learn from this experiment.
Well, I also want to read an email here that makes a point going back to the fact that these are remedial courses that are being offered in this pilot program at San Jose State. This is Dana from, or Dana from Berkeley, who says, I hate to go off the topic, but the fact that the CSU system is looking to find ways to get their students qualified to take university-level courses through these online classes is an indication of the real failure in the system, the public elementary school system. We need to focus way more of our resources on getting kids ready for school when they're 3 years old and helping them learn the skills they need to succeed in high school, so that no one needs to take remedial classes in college. The percentage needing remedial classes in college is absurd. And I'd like to go back, Michael Moranz, to you on this whole question of what online education, as it continues to proliferate possibly, is going to do with respect to, well, graduate students who are hired to do as teaching assistants and courses that are generally entry-level courses and all that. I mean, it shifts and changes the whole terrain, doesn't it?
It does. And can I just want to make one point of clarification before I respond to that. The notion that you want to engage in inquiry or experiment to see if specific problems can be solved with these technologies, I think it makes perfect sense. I would, however, caution against the rhetoric of we should innovate because we're an innovative country. You know, innovation is one of these words that sounds really great as a soundbite. Innovation in the financial industry gave us the financial collapse. Innovation is neither in and of itself good or bad.
Also and greed in that, respect to greed. The...
Yeah,
due respect.
But I'm just saying, if you look at it, they came up with all sorts of new innovative ways to market things. They have new technologies that do buying and selling in a split second. I mean, all of these things help to make the financial sector completely unstable and out of control. So I think we need to step back from this rhetoric that innovation equals good and is America's destiny. What we need to be doing is engaging in inquiries about specific problems and experiments, and then trying to use the skills of people like and imaginations of people like Sebastian Thrun to try to see if there are ways to solve these problems. In terms of the question of graduate students, I think that that's a tremendous concern, both because you run the risk of setting up these classes in such a way as you have fewer and fewer faculty, more and more graduate students who are already facing difficult job situations, but are then being used to train, you know, basically to do all the interactions at low pay with little future. You create a complete set of even more permanent instructional underclass in higher education. And the other thing about that is that graduate students are, in an important way, are seed corn for research and inquiry in the future. And if, in fact, you start shifting resources from faculty to graduate students in the sense of hiring less faculty, hiring more graduate students so they can manage these massive courses, no one is going to actually be training the graduate students. The graduate students will not be having the opportunities to do their research. They will not be exploring new frontiers of knowledge. And the whole system of knowledge production, of learning, of research will ultimately collapse unless there's sufficient reinvestment in these institutions to allow for that sort of continuity. And online is not going to destroy it if it's done in, you know, specific ways to try to enrich experience or to solve certain problems. But if it is done as a way of substituting for actual public investment in the future of education, beginning, as your previous commenter said, in K through 12, then we will, in fact, be undermining the possibility of continuing to develop.
And again, Michael Moranz is professor of history at UCLA, co-editor of the blog Remaking the University. Let me get another caller on here who's a faculty member over at Cal State East Bay. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi, thank you very much. I'd like to say hello to Mo. I had the opportunity to work with Mo when he was at Cal State East Bay. As a faculty member, what I would like to speak to and follow up on what the last caller was just saying, while the online push has been going on in the Cal State system and Cal State East Bay has taken a lead in that, we've also been seeing very, very significant cuts to all kinds of support for faculty. And what online education represents is a significant shift in how people learn and pedagogy and teaching and how people learn. And while there have been the opportunities and the technology available to provide education and learning online, there hasn't been concomitant support for faculty in learning how to do this so that it works, so that learning can happen effectively. And you read an email from a student at Cal State East Bay that had taken an online course and felt that it wasn't an effective experience. The reason that happens is that faculty are not being provided with the support in terms of expertise in learning in an online environment and the release time that they need to make the shift to a different learning environment.
Well, that note for faculty support will be the final word here. You get it, Sharon, and thank you for the call. And thanks to all of you who called in. In fact, you can continue this conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum. I want to thank President of San Jose State, Mo Kayomi, Sebastian Thrun, here with us in studio from Udacity, founder of it, Michael Moranz from UCLA, editor of the blog, Remaking the University, co-editor, and Jonathan Stein, who is a University of California student region. Another hour of Forum up ahead with Deepak Chopra. Join us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.